also a few questions here. So, to desire, I wonder if you could speak a little about positive desire, desire that is not tanha. What is the positive, what is the Pali term for positive desire? Desire such as for right practice, right speech, etc. When do these desires become tanha, or do they even, perhaps as when one becomes too extreme? Is it positive desire to be warm enough, have food enough? So we have biological need, right? Biological desire, right? So that's, if you don't have that, you're in trouble. Some time ago in Life magazine, there was some kid who didn't feel pain. Remember that? Weird, didn't feel pain. So mama always had to check the kid, whether the kid broke his leg or not. So this, the desire is biological. For food, for comfort, if we didn't have that, we couldn't survive. And so that's just the nature of things. So the desire for food is natural if I'm hungry. But if I'm bored or sad or depressed and I eat 5 Timbits, you know, what's that? That's a different kind of desire. It's a desire to escape from the unpleasant and absorb into the pleasant. Right? So all you know, modern culture, all issues around food. So this is like biological desire. And then psychological desire is something that comes up like wanting to be loved, wanting to be liked, wanting praise, not wanting, you know, so it gets more complicated. The Pali word for right desire or wholesome desire is chanda. And it's usually has a very Victorian translation, zeal. But it is that in us which aspires to goodness. Now, again, but it comes from just the fundamental sense that all of us want to be happy. In other words, as long as I am unhappy in some way, just being human, I'm going to look for a way for happiness. So if I'm cold, I'll put a coat on. If I'm thirsty, I'll drink something. I'll drink some water. If I'm lonely, if I'm fearful, if there's a bear, I have to give a talk. It's different, isn't it? You know, it's not so good. So some of the fears I have are biological, but some of the fears are psychological, and they've been programmed into consciousness through lack of through just life, right? Just, you know, being a human being. But when they begin to manifest, they begin to manifest as a sense of self. So my desire for happiness, then, and I run away from the fear, or I believe in the anger, and I hate people, or I don't want to be with aloneness, so I smoke dope, or things like that, then I'm really lost in it. And then I hear a teaching, and the teaching says, well, why don't you look at your suffering first before you make these assumptions? Why don't you have a look at the way you're running away from this suffering? And why don't you question this? And this is the beginning of intelligence, really. And then the teaching says, well, if you do this, then you'll get this insight, you get right understanding. Right? And then from right understanding, you know, you'll know how to direct your mind. You get right thought. And from right thought, you're going to see, if I act, or I speak, or my livelihood, you start to get a sense of livelihood. And then if I make this kind of effort, I make this kind of concentration, I make this kind of mindfulness, it leads to really good results. So you have a whole eightfold path. And the doing of that is what's called chanda. It's an aspiration for freedom. But it's still the same. It's the same desire for happiness. It's just like, the Buddha's just saying, you know, we all want to be happy, just make sure you're doing it right. Don't take a path which leads to more suffering. So ignorance is the path which just kind of takes you down into more suffering, that's all. So it's quite natural in the nature of things. And of course the Buddha's discovery of something profound in consciousness is what makes him a Buddha. Which makes him more than just someone that helps you in some kind of cognitive way to be a better person, those are good things. Because, you know, there's a profound realization that he comes up with. And from that realization, he starts to talk about the unconditioned. And so you get the idea that the method, as I keep saying, the method is compassion. The method is patience, not the goal. And you begin to see that the method of like opening the heart, staying present, allows you to begin to just be silent with the way things are. And then that silence takes care of things. So that's the path. And the love of that path, and the love of that work, as it were, or the hobby, is Chanda. That's what we mean by Chanda. And then Tanha is always conjoined with ignorance. So, you know, when I'm reacting to some emotional, like, emotional state, and I think I'm being diligent, but I'm just trying to get rid of it, even though I'm aspiring to goodness, I don't understand it, that's Tanha. It's not very deliberate, it's just I still haven't understood yet. And as long as I make those efforts from this wrong viewpoint, wrong understanding, I'm not going to get a good result. And if I don't get a good result, back to the drawing board. When all else fails, read the instructions. The instructions are suffering the cause of the end of the path. And we do that, don't we? You know, you're going to try, oh, I don't know what's going on, and oh, I see what's going on. You know, and this is just the nature of our trying. It has to be conjoined with ignorance when we start. How else do we start? You mean we fumble a lot. But if we keep to the good intention, and then we keep looking, this isn't working. There's something, I haven't understood something. So it is, that's why it's a wisdom teaching. You know, it's a teaching of insight, of inquiry, of true intelligence. So that's, and when does, when do these, like right speech and so on, when do they become tanha? It's when, like effort especially, you can see, like, I know I've made effort with a lot of willpower, but it hasn't been wisdom. It's been conjoined with ignorance. So, a lot of effort, but the effort to get rid of, the effort to become, so that's wrong effort. Yeah. But there's enough desire to say, okay, this isn't working. When is desire? Talk to the teacher, watch the result, try something, look at that. And that's the path, kind of fumbling around, a lot of fumbling around, trying stuff out. And a lot of that you can read in the books, but it's just, you just sort of do it, then you get an insight, then you read the book, so I see what they're talking about. It's true, isn't it? You go back to something you saw 5 years ago and say, oh yeah. Didn't have a clue then. And insight is quite wonderful that way. And of course then, that insight leads to confidence. So you go from faith to confidence. Faith is the willingness to try. Right? If you believe in Buddhism and leave it there, you're stuck. Right? You won't get anywhere. You just have a Buddhist belief. Then, you know, it's all right, belief. But it won't liberate you. It'll just be, I believe in karma, I don't believe in self, you know, I believe in Santa Claus, or it'll still be just an idea. But if you implement that idea, then that takes you to confidence. And so like in the text they talk, someone who has confidence is beyond belief, beyond faith. Because you really know, knowing. Like if anyone tells me right now, you'd be really happy if you kill someone. Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't believe it. I know. I just know the way, and so on. So that whole aspiration that we have is Chanda, that's what it's called. And then a question which I'm not very good on, in a couple relationship, I need much help. Because I've matured in community. You know, I came into community, I was 23, and a young 23. And so I never really, you know, developed maturity that way, but I developed maturity through community. In a couple relationship, do you have any advice on how do we know if we should continue together or take different paths? I guess the theme would be doubt. Doubt can do a lot of damage in a relationship, and it's not easy to see clearly sometimes. So, there's one little nice little piece in the text which says there are three factors for a good relationship. Three is that the, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but one of them is that the couple have an equal proclivity to morality, an equal sense of morality. So if they're both bank robbers, great. If they're both really moral, great. But if one's a bank robber and one's moral, it ain't going to work. Second one, that they both have the same level of generosity. So if they're both mean-spirited, fine. If they're both very generous, good. But if one's mean-spirited and one's generous, you're going to have problems. And the third is their inclination to reflection on Dhamma. So both are really worldly and just like, you know, into worldly things and go for it that way, fine. If both are contemplative and reflecting on dukkha and so forth, good. But if one is just into worldly things and the other one is reflected, you got problems. And that you see that, don't you? You know, where especially I think with couples that in the beginning their interests are the same, and one person's moving towards Dharma and the other is staying in worldly pursuits, it's very hard. It's very hard in that way. Like, so when to hang in, beats me. I can certainly speak to monastics, you know, when to hang in. I sit all the time. But having said that, I've seen, you know, people who get stuck in monasticism who it's good that they disrobe, you know, because they just get somehow stuck in a, for us, say, they get stuck in a place where there's no joy, no heart. Somehow they haven't understood how to open the heart in this life, and then it's good that they go. Painful, it's difficult, but it's probably good for them to just get shaken up a bit. It's a difficult move. So I suppose, like, in terms of commitment, I mean, there's something very powerful about commitment, but there's nothing in the text that says you have to be committed, you have to be responsible, right? But there's nothing in the text say that, you know, like, till death do us part isn't a kind of Buddhist thing. Like monastics, we don't take a vow till death do us part. We pick up a training. So we pick up the training, and when we want to disrobe, we can put down the training. There's one monk who disrobed six times. I can imagine the Buddha the seventh time. Oh, come on. <Back again. laughs> But, so, I think for me, in terms of just work or any, when you can no longer be mindful of conflict, like let's say work and burnout, there's something about being committed to a vocation or work where you are challenged, but when the challenges become so strong that you're constantly overwhelmed, and that's burnout, you can't practice, and that's dangerous. Not, you know, it's like psychologically dangerous, but the kind of negative tendency, you just burn them into consciousness even more, and it takes a long time to recover from burnout. So there is, you know, just to kind of grit your teeth and bear it all the time, that's not appropriate. And then in terms of relationship, it's all like, again, like what I said earlier, the teachings are always this mutual respect and mutual responsibility, that kind of mutuality. But then the choices people make, I'm just like, don't know really. So if you have a spiritual aspiration, then I suppose my question would be, you know, can you use the unsatisfactoriness of this to go beyond unsatisfactoriness? Can you use it to develop clarity around letting go? And also, is it, like, obviously, if it's abusive or it's immoral, then just cash in your chips, get out of there. To me, that seems pretty obvious. But it's a complicated thing because people get so close to each other, and there are financial issues, and And, you know, going somewhere else isn't necessarily going to vet her. So I don't really know. I've certainly seen with monastics sometimes people will disrobe with a very naive idea. You know, and you know, they're gonna, you know, like, you know, I'm really together now. You think so? You're dumb, okay. And they go out and get burned. They're this kind of overconfidence in the Dhamma. They don't see it. I mean, the whole monastery is like it held them together. And then they disrobe. And they say, well, go for it. And then they usually get burned for a few years. And then they wake up and you say, oh, it wasn't as easy as I thought. So I've seen that, where that kind of naive rejection of a particular commitment form. But then I've also seen people like stay in the form and begin to die in it, emotionally die. And then you know, oh, they've got to get out. So it's such, yeah, probably like, I don't know. it's a hard question. But that one about the relationships, I find that one interesting, those three. The three aspects, rather than like what movies you like. Something like that. I enjoy calling up a company to thank them for exceptional services or products. I get a chuckle out of doing this. Is that appropriate? Getting a chuckle. or is that a form of egotism? Yeah, well, go for it. You want chuckle? Chuckle. I think that's it, huh? So just to conclude, don't worry, be happy. So how to like develop this practice? Sila Samadhi Panya, the triad that the shrine represents, a good ethical framework to protect you and to bring forth the kind of noble qualities in society. Samadhi, developing the capacity to compose the mind, collect the mind, and getting really good at that. It's like training, like learning about, first of all, figuring out what works for you, breath, heart, space, and then honing that like a skill, and just getting better at it, till you enjoy doing it, till you really like the hobby. Any hobby, you know, when you start a hobby, you're just like all over the shelf, aren't you? And then you somehow, and again, I keep going back to that, don't I? How do you learn? You learn by doing. You know, I picked up this kind of card reading stuff, like I said, and it was so complicated. It was just so, I didn't have a teacher, just these books, and I just would have strings all over the place, right? And trying to get attention, and I don't know. Now I can do it. And I don't really know how I learned, but I learned. If I had to kind of repeat the steps, I couldn't really tell you. So I just fumbled and struggled and then got ticked off and then got excited and I just kept at it. Now I can do that. And that's the same with meditation. You can't really describe it. You can, if you can. It's here and there. But there's something about just doing it and doing it a lot. So if you want to cultivate that skill, you do have to invest the time. You really do have to kind of try to carve out some time in your life. And it has to be in that spirit of inquiry. If it's another thing that you think you have to do, like, oh, I have to exercise, I have to eat less butter, have to meditate, you know, it just becomes this kind of burden. But if you're really interested in the mind, and you're interested in that skill, then you'll carve out the time. That's very, in our culture, it's very important. But panya, that the third aspect, insight, is something that you're doing all the time. Mindfulness meditation is something you're doing all the time. There's awakening, and then seeing how you react to people, and getting better and better at that. And then if there is some bit in your social life, which is really confusing, but not immoral or abusive, say, and it's repeated, like it's repetitive, then there's a great learning there. Because there's something about that situation that presses your buttons and you don't understand. So if you can prepare your mind for that, you say, okay, when I'm in that situation, I'm going to try to notice how confusion arises or how the reaction I have to the person physically. You prepare the mind. So you can kind of prepare the mind for mindfulness around difficult issues. So it might be like people have like problems with their siblings maybe at Christmas, right? You know, you kind of walk away, you know, survive in their Christmas. Or something like that. You kind of prepare yourself. Okay, so when I go home, I'm going to just see what the reaction is. Rather than, oh, I'm not going to say anything. And then blurt something out. But, you know, and then you can prepare yourself. Okay, how does this arise? So you can prepare yourself for mindfulness in that way. As opposed to the judgment that you should be different. That's not really mindfulness, that's just judgment. You have an aspiration to be a better person, but you have to understand it first. When you understand it, then you can make appropriate effort. And that's all the time. Mindfulness meditation is all the time. And you get better and better at it.